everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Baldwin. With me, my co-host from Huntsville, Alabama, the king of the leg drop, beautiful Barry Rose. Barry, how you doing today?
Man, I'm living the dream, Jeff. How you doing today?
Living la vida loca. Is that what it, you're doing, Barry?
That's it, kind of. Yeah, I don't look as good as Ricky Martin looks, but
well,
I am living la vida loca, so yeah.
So on this show, we're not just going to talk about Ricky Martin. We're going to break kayfabe on the wrestling business, sports, movies, television, pop culture. We are going to break kayfabe on life. Okay, so there we go, folks. So here we are, episode 63. What have we got planned for you? That is what you are asking yourself today. Barry and I are, first of all, going to answer a few more questions left over from last week's well thought of, well received. They love us, Barry. The Q&A segment. We're gonna throw a few more questions at ourselves that we're gonna answer from the audience and the message board, as well as we are going to talk about two matches today that we have seen recently. One a little bit historical. We're talking 1980 Maple Leaf Gardens, and the other one, Barry, was one you talked about last week, which I believe happened last year at NXT Chicago.
Yeah, so I think, if I recall correctly, it was last week or the week before, and we talked about the greatest matches to ever take place on NXT, and I believe this was my number one match. And it's phenomenal. I went back, and I think I've watched it four or five times since the match took place last year. And every time I watch it, I think I pick up something new. So, so I'm excited that you got to see it, and I'm excited to hear what you thought about it.
So we're going to be talking about Tyler Bate versus Pete Dunne from last year from Chicago. And we're going to be talking about Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood versus the Superfly Brudda, Jimmy Snuka and Ray Stevens from Maple Leaf Gardens 1980. And we are also going to be doing a deep dive, no top five, because we'll explain why when we get to this segment. We are going to be looking at game shows. And we want to thank Ryan Damon for a great question that inspired this bit. And Dave Morningweg, who posted a thread about his favorite game show host. So we're going to be talking about both our favorite game shows and our favorite game show host. And we're going to be getting into that. So before we get into that, Barry and I have been talking here on the old Breaking Kayfabe. We are going to have this idea that I will give credit where it's due. Mr. Rose came up with this idea to do an interactive movie group because, you know, we are so involved and such big fans of the movie industry and watching films. Barry, why don't you tell the good folks a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I'm going to try to explain this as coherently as I possibly can.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so you know what? If three people understand me, I would consider this successful. But to that end, Jeff, so I was in Denver, Colorado last week, and I sat next to a gentleman from France, of all places, but he lives in New York City now, and somehow the topic of Die Hard being the greatest Christmas movie ever came up. So immediately,
I had
a new best friend, Jeff. I had a new best friend. This guy goes, of course it's a Christmas movie and it's the greatest of all time. Immediately we bonded. And then he goes, have you ever heard of a movie called Old Boy? So when I picked myself up off the ground, I gave this guy a big hug. I said, of course I have. Probably my favorite foreign film of all time. He goes, I belong to a movie club. And he said it with that French accent that I will never attempt to do. So what they do, he and 4, 5, 6, 7, I don't know what the exact number was, group of friends, each one of them will choose a movie, and then they have 7 days to watch the movie, and they put all of their notes in a Google spreadsheet, which is their way of kind of discussing the movie. So in essence, I mean, you know, if we were doing it, maybe we would do it on Facebook or something like that. But I reached out to you and I said, Jeff, I think I've got a great idea. What if we do the Breaking Kayfabe Movie Club? And you and I talked through it and you thought, I obviously was very excited upon hearing this. So Jeff and I would like to announce the Breaking Kayfabe Movie Club coming to you. What it basically is going to be, it's going to be Jeff and myself. We're going to alternate choosing the movie of the week, and we're going to take volunteers. We've already got three lined up for the first week, but we're looking for three volunteers every week to review a movie with us. And then in every episode, we're actually going to go in and read the reviews. So it'll be kind of a kayfabe theater kind of deal where we'll obviously read our own, but at the same time, we're going to pick out some great comments and reviews from our listeners. So to that end, when you're hearing this, we're going to start looking for future volunteers to join us. So please, you know, obviously we always discuss everything that takes place on our Facebook group. You know, Jeff and I practically live there at this point. But if you're interested and you want to be a part of it, just let us know, reach out somehow, and we're definitely going to be including you.
So this is a chance, dare I say, for those of you out there that don't feel they get enough love on the podcast, here is your chance to reach out to us, whether it's in the on the message board, private message us, and say, I want in. I want to be in on this. And we are going to alternate picking a movie of the week, as Barry said, and you will be able to write your thoughts, your views, your comments on a particular movie that we pick out each week. So I think that'll be a lot of fun because, you know, everyone's opinions on movies are usually very wide and diverse, such as wondering whether or not Die Hard is a friggin' Christmas movie. Some people think it is. Others, I'm thinking more Christmas Story, Elf, something along those. It had, you know, what do you call Jimmy Stewart? Why can't I think of it right now, Barry? Jimmy Stewart, 1946.
It's a Wonderful Life.
Thank you. That is a fucking Christmas movie. So we're going to be offering more intel, more information on that in the future. Speaking of movies, Barry, I have been saving this one for a long time, and I'm going to throw this at you. I'm reading the magazine Empire that I pick up every single month at the old Barnes & Noble. And they offer tons of intel on movies new and old. Barry, I know one of your favorite movies, you have discussed it on this show before, is, of course, Midnight Run. Am I correct, sir?
Oh, my God. Absolutely.
So, according to Empire Magazine, Barry, do you know who this of course, famously, Charles Grodin and Robert De Niro were the stars of the movie, correct?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so, who did the studio want originally to play the two lead roles?
Oh, wow. I don't know this one either. So you're definitely blind surprising me with this one.
Yes,
I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm going to say the movie came out in 1988. They don't want De Niro and Grodin. De Niro was a box office draw. Grodin definitely wasn't at that stage, though he was fantastic in that movie. They wanted Mel Gibson and Carrot Top to play those roles. Am I right, Jeff?
Strong guess, but the answer is even more bizarre. The story goes...
More bizarre than Carrot Top?
Yes. That wow. Director Martin Brest decided that he was going to stick to his guns, dig his heels in, and say no to the studio. We're making this movie with De Niro and Grodin as opposed to who the studio wanted. I'm not even kidding. Robin Williams and Cher.
Wow.
Boom! Brest. That is some serious knowledge that I'm dropping on you folks here, and I hope you sure appreciate it, for God's sakes.
That is serious intel there.
That's pretty incredible, isn't it?
We need to hold Martin Brest in high regard because we wouldn't be talking about Midnight Run at any point if it had fucking Cher and Robin Williams in it. So, yeah, 100%, Jeff. Wow.
Absolutely. So I saw something online today, Barry, more stuff I'm throwing at you unannounced, that today, the day we are recording this, would have been the 66th birthday of Sylvester Ritter, the man they called the Junkyard Dog. Barry, very quickly, memories of JYD.
Memories of JYD. Positive memories in working for Watts. And that's about all I can say. He was apparently a decent human being. He made a lot of mistakes in his life. And, you know, his death was tragic. What a way to die. You know, just very, very sad. I think the one thing, I remember reading an article with JYD, and it was Sylvester Ritter. And I think he had played college ball in Tennessee, if I'm correct. I'm not positive of that. But there was a newspaper article that came out in the early stages of his career. And I want to say it's late 70s. He's wrestling for Stu Hart up in Calgary. I think he was Sylvester Ritter up there as well. And he's talking
about...
He
was actually Big Daddy Ritter up there, I believe.
Big Daddy Ritter, that's right. And he was talking about how he was going to get out of professional wrestling at a young age in his mid-30s, and he was going to save his money and open up some sort of side business. And as we all know, that completely went off the rails, and did not happen. So kind of tragic. You know, he was never a great worker, or I don't know, maybe he was a good worker. He was never a great wrestler. And, you know, Bill Watts was very smart. You know, I'll always say top three bookers of all time, and Watts is right up there. And Watts was able to kind of camouflage whatever his shortcomings were, less so in the WWE. And if I remember correctly, he actually came to WCW, the NWA, at one point also. Didn't really make much of an impact. That being said, this guy had charisma. And I will say, if you haven't heard the song Grab Them Cakes in 20 or 30 years, when that was a big hit with the WWF, you should go back, because it really is. It is funny to listen to that song, Grab Them Cakes.
Well, I will just say this, that the Junkyard Dog, who at some point in the WWF and into his WCW days became the Junk Food Dog, that's what they called him, based on a nickname that was created, I believe, by Meltzer. That's not the same guy that was in Mid-South from about 1979 to about 1984. That guy, if you talk to anybody, Mike Mills, my friends Jeff and David Steele, anybody that lived in that sort of section of the country that was watching Mid-South every single weekend, hold JYD in almost a I'll just say rarefied air, because he was not just a wrestler. He became, you know, I want to say it's similar to what Dusty became in the mid-70s in Florida. He wasn't, you know, I don't want to say cultural icon. That sounds so, you know, passe. But the way the Von Erichs were held in regard in Texas, the way that Dusty was in the mid-70s, the way that Ric Flair was in the mid-Atlantic. I mean, you know, he just becomes part of the cultural fabric of that area. And that's what the JYD became. And especially, I mean, dare I say, here you had in a very poor, economically challenged area with a lot of, I'm sure, unemployment among black people. He was a black superstar that they could believe in. This was not just a guy they thrust out to the black. Because trust me, after he left, Watts kept pushing guys that weren't ready for that position, you know, that were black athletes into that position that failed. But when he
Everyone failed.
Yes. When he put Sylvester Ritter in that spot, he took off as the JYD, and people that were black, white, red, and green believed in the Junkyard Dog. And, you know, the whole Whodat thing that everyone thinks started with the New Orleans Saints, that started with the Junkyard Dog.
Yeah, it was, and that, yeah, and his stuff in Mid-South was really, it was incredible. And again, I give a lot of credit to Bill Watts. I give a lot of credit to the Freebirds, because that whole angle with the Freebirds was just absolutely incredible. He just never really captured that magic. I know they tried in the WWF, and I think initially there was some success with it. But I think partly it was his hard partying lifestyle. Really wasn't a secret. He was packing on a lot of weight, wasn't motivated, and it really showed. And it's a shame, because by all accounts, he was a really decent guy as well.
Yeah, and you know, famously, I can recall that that Bill Watts, towards the end of his Mid-South run, as he was beginning to noticeably put on weight, Bill Watts said in one of the episodes that he's bulking up for the winter, or something along those lines,
to cover up. Watts.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, let's be honest, as you alluded to, one of the things that Bill Watts did better, maybe than any other booker, was to cover up the flaws in the people that he was trying to push. So here you have the JYD. JYD is not going to go out and be the Dynamite Kid. Let's be honest. I don't think I'm breaking any real ground there. But what he did was he put him with guys like the Freebirds. He put him with guys like Ted DiBiase, guys that could play to what his weaknesses were and make them and turn them into strengths. Or at least turn them into where they weren't a liability. And of course, I've talked about it before, the famous story where I believe he was supposed to have a TV match with Lynn Denton, the grappler. And Lynn Denton decided that he wanted to show Bill Watts just how good he really was, and went out there and started just working all kind of stuff with the dog, and ended up going to a draw. And he got back to the back, and Bill Watts wanted to fire him and Ernie Ladd. And they said, why? He said, I didn't want you to show me what you could do. I wanted to see what he could do. And Ernie Ladd said, boss, point taken. And that's what Bill Watts did. He played to what you could do, not what you could not do. And that was one of the strengths of Bill Watts. I will mention another anniversary yesterday, the day of this taping, Barry. Here's another one I'm going to throw out of you unannounced. The anniversary 5 years since the death of Tom Laughlin, the Billy Jack from the movies. Please tell me you've seen the Billy Jack movies, Barry.
Oh, I've seen every one. And when he died, it was odd because he was still involved, I guess, in certain causes. And I hadn't heard about him in years, so I Googled him, and I want to say he was like late 70s or 80 years old. And of course, in my mind, Billy Jack was still Billy Jack from the movies 40, 45 years ago, without ever realizing that, you know, he was now a senior citizen. So, yeah, he was that's somebody we really haven't given a lot of love to, you know, on our podcast.
Here's the thing. I saw the first Billy Jack. I want to say I was maybe 11 or 12 years old. And, you know, there was no Chuck. This wasn't the 80s. There wasn't a Chuck Norris or a Sylvester Stallone or any of those guys. And when you see Billy Jack play this, for the uninitiated, he's this Vietnam vet, a Green Beret who comes back. He's half Indian. So, of course, the white people in town, the rednecks, don't like him. He's really maybe not fully accepted by the Indian population either. He's what Cher sang about in Half Breed, for God's sakes. But he protects the young kids that go to this Indian school. And who is that guy? We mentioned him in our best character actors. Was it Bert Fried that played like the town boss? I think that might have been Bert Fried. But and there's the great scene. Go and YouTube this because it's really fantastic where he says, "You know what I'm going to do just for the hell of it?" And the town boss goes, "What?" He goes, "I'm going to take this right foot and I'm going to kick you on the right side of your face. And there's not a damn thing you can do about it." And he gives them this like swinging leg kick and just boom, just totally knocks them out. And in 1971, this was even before friggin' Bruce Lee. And you're going, "Holy shit, that's the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life." And, you know, the movie is very like, supportive of Indian causes and, you know, points out things that have been done to the Indians that weren't fair and, you know, like that. And of course, there's a song, I believe, that's done by the group Coven called 110 Soldier that came out of that movie. But Tom Laughlin, he was quite the activist in his day. And they did Billy Jack Goes to Washington. They did the Trial of Billy Jack. And none of the follow-ups had as much success. But Billy Jack, the original movie, was like a cultural phenomenon, Barry.
Yeah, it definitely was, too. And it's now that we're talking about it, it makes me want to go watch a Billy Jack movie. I haven't seen one of them in years now. And I'm thinking to myself, you know what? That would be a great choice. It's Thursday night. We're recording this on a Thursday. Little secret is out, Jeff. And I literally have no more plans after we're done recording. So I'm thinking, man, Billy Jack, my ass on a couch. Perfect.
Yeah, go ahead and hate your neighbor. Go ahead and cheat a friend. That's all I'll sing from the Coven song, 110 Soldier, and I think that's all you probably want to hear. Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. Before we go on and start talking about our matches, Barry, I believe you have a little bit of a special announcement that you want to make to the good folks listening here about something we have coming up, but if not the next episode, then the episode after that, which, you know, we're talking either Christmas or New Year's. We're going to have a special guest on this show. Am I right, Mr. Rose?
Yes, we will be having a special guest. It's a friend of both you and I. It's somebody that was in the wrestling business for some 30 years, worked literally every region, every territory, one of the nicest guys you will ever meet, and a guy also that has his autobiography coming out. We are talking about Bugsy McGraw. So Bugsy McGraw, the Brute, Sailor Brutus, Beautiful Brutus. He had a lot of aliases, but he's most well known as Bugsy McGraw. And he's done his autobiography, and I'm pretty friendly with his co-author, who is Ian Douglas, and sent me a copy of the book, I don't know, maybe 6-7 weeks ago. And I literally sat down, I started reading it, Jeff, and it was PDF file. And I was probably 30 minutes into it, and I looked over at the clock, and I'm like, all right, I can do this tonight. And I think the next 3.5 hours, I sat there, and I read every word, every page, and I devoured it. And it's a history lesson, and I was talking with Bugsy today about this, and I said, what I liked about your book, and there's a lot of things I liked about it. One was, as I'm reading the book, I'm hearing your voice, which really is what you want when you're reading a book. You know, you want to read the author's voice. He's an amazing storyteller, as a lot of wrestlers are. He's a fantastic storyteller. There was some kind of shocking or surprising stories in there about his relationships with several people that, you know, when you watch Bugsy, who was arguably the number two babyface in the state of Florida in the late 70s and early 80s. And when I say arguably, he's possibly right there with Dusty Rhodes. Bugsy, when he turned babyface, was absolutely huge and equaled Dusty in popularity. And I think Dusty was aware of that. But there was some fractures in that relationship that I just was riveted by. And every time I've talked with Bugsy since, I bring it up and I'm like, I got to admit, you tell this one story and I'm not going to divulge it right now, but holy cow. So Bugsy does have this book coming out. He and his co-author, Ian Douglas, have chosen to come to the fine folks at Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry, being yourself, me, and are the great Brian Last, and they will now be advertising with us as we get this off the ground. So I'm real excited, Jeff, that you and I are on the ground floor of this. They are doing a Kickstarter link. This is self-publishing at its finest, and they're doing a Kickstarter link. It will be posted in our Facebook group this coming Tuesday. And we're also going to be posting the same time the publisher's description of the book and its contents. And I got to say, this is pretty cool for me, Jeff. So I've seen the book, I've seen the cover and the back cover as well. And the author, Ian, reached out to me and wanted a quote about what I thought about the book. So my cover is prominently displayed on the back cover. Of course, the front cover went to this guy named Dave Meltzer and this other guy named Jim Ross.
Who?
Who? Exactly. Who? I can't compete with those guys. Actually, I can compete with those guys. But in any case, I got the back cover, and it's fantastic. And I think this is one of those books that, you know, whether you're a fan or not of Bugsy McGraw, these stories are so interesting that you're going to be just taken in by this. So we are going to have Bugsy on our show, which he has not done any other podcast, Jeff. So that's always a coup. But Bugsy will be on the show coming up shortly. But I just wanted to give a quick rundown. So they're doing this Kickstarter. And again, we're going to post all this information in our Facebook group. So you don't need to get a pen and paper and start writing this down. But $10 is going to get you a personalized thank you postcard from Bugsy. And it's actually a postcard of the book cover. Bugsy will autograph it and personalize it. For $19, you will get the Brute Power, and that's the name. It's the Brute Power, the autobiography of Bugsy McGraw with Ian Douglas. For $29, you get an autographed copy of the Brute Power autobiography. For $40, an autographed book and a signed photo. $44, two autographed copies of Brute Power. So you can get one, and then you can give one to your friend, you know, which is always a nice gesture. $75 will get you two autographed copies and your name on the thank you page in the book. So you get your name in print for $75. The next thing, which is $150, I am doing personally. And when Ian told me about this, he goes, I bet you're going to do that. And I'm like, fuck yeah, I'm going to do this, Ian. I'll send you the check right now, whatever you need. So for $150, you get an autographed copy of Brute Power, a hardbound copy of Bugsy's three personal career scrapbooks with more than 500 photos, programs, and newspaper clippings from his entire career. So Bugsy, much like...
Hold on right here. I'll back it up. Now all of a sudden, my ears kind of perked up there. So he's made... And you did tell me, but as we spoke earlier, that Bugsy, much like guys like Jim Cornette, J.J. Dillon, has kept scrapbooks of his career. So he's made copies of all this stuff and put it into a scrapbook that he's going to give those that reach out for this price and are interested in this?
Yeah, so I don't know if it's – I know that it was three scrapbooks, and I think they took all the information to make one hardbound book. But this is a lot of stuff that's never been seen before. These are rare photos. There is, you know, some newspaper clippings or programs, but this is – a lot of this is one-of-a-kind stuff. And to what you just said – when you look at the books that have been put out by guys like Jim Cornette and J.J. Dillon, and I'll always say J.J. Dillon's book, in my opinion, is the greatest wrestling book of all time, maybe with the exception of the Breaking Kayfabe book that you published, Jeff.
Well, but, I digress.
Well, I'm putting you in some lofty company right there. But honestly, the success of J.J.'s book were the details and the fact that he kept these journals. So to hear that Bugsy has got all these scrapbooks of his career to me was great. And I figured, you know what, $150, I'll get some autographed copies of this book. I'm 100% about that. If you really want to play ball here and you want to make a big contribution, for $1,200, you can go and you can have dinner with Bugsy. You can invite your friends. You can go to the restaurant of your choice, I believe in Daytona, would be in the state of Florida, and you can sit and you can have dinner with Bugsy. There's no time limit. There's no type of question that you can't ask, though I don't know what you would ask other than wrestling. But if you are interested, you know, they're looking. They're really trying to get the word out. And again, this is self-publishing. This is Renegade Publishing, which I have a lot of respect for. So,
Two quick questions, Barry. The final fee you said was what, $1,200 you said?
$1,200 for the dinner, correct.
Okay. So now is that $1,200, do you take the check at the end of the dinner or does Bugsy pick up the check?
It probably depends where you eat.
Okay.
If you go to a place like Chima, I'm going to assume that the person buying it is going to be picking up the check. If you're hitting Denny's or Perkins, I would think maybe Bugsy's picking up the check on that.
Oh, that's nice.
I'm not sure, but that's what I'm thinking.
So I'm wondering right now, since the event would take place in Florida, is Bobby Van Kevlar already making plans to write that check for Bugsy to take him, you know, take him? Well, anyway, so I digress. But no, this sounds like a super interesting, prospects and idea. And I want to just point this out to you folks, because this is something in the interview that will be forthcoming on this show here. Think about this. Bugsy McGraw worked in San Francisco for Roy Scheider. Bugsy McGraw worked in Madison Square Garden against Bruno Sammartino. That's before he even gets to Florida and becomes, you know, Mr. USA and becomes the lead babyface in Florida for, yeah, Barry, what are we talking, a good year or two that he was pretty much the lead babyface?
Yeah, so when he turned it, and I'll say this out, and I actually wrote this in print in an old Terry Robert Justice newsletter, and when Bugsy turned in 1980, Bugsy went from the top heel in the state to the top babyface, and I didn't use those words, obviously. I was saying good and bad guy, but I wrote it that his first week in Miami as a babyface, he was as popular, if not more popular, than Dusty Rhodes was at that stage.
Yeah, I believe that Bugsy was super, super over at that point. There's no question about it. He had the really, dare I say, out there interviews. He would offer up thoughts on the cosmos as part of his interview style. So yeah, we really are going to be providing more information, like we said, on the Facebook message board, something we want to encourage you all to check out. Depending on which option you might be thinking of, I think there's gold in them there heels for you to check out, folks. And I think it's definitely something that if you're interested, we're ever a fan of Bugsy McGraw, it's something to definitely look into. This is a lot of history that we're going to be covering here, Barry.
Yeah, it really is, too. And I'm super excited that we're able to be a part of it, as I said. Jeff, I am actually forwarding the book to you as we speak. So you'll have a copy of it. And I'm looking forward to talking to Bugsy. The cool thing about him, he's the nicest guy in the face of the earth. He's also highly intelligent. So a lot of what you saw, and Bugsy has a great sense of humor, but he's a really, really bright guy. He loves to talk about professional wrestling. And I have warned him, Jeff. I warned him of a couple things. I warned him that we're going to discuss things other than wrestling, whether it's sports, food, movies, music, possibly life. And I did tell him, Jeff, that you are a huge Notre Dame fan.
Well, and you reminded me today that Bugsy apparently played football at Purdue, the Boilermakers.
Yeah.
So I'm sure we'll have an interesting Notre Dame-Purdue conversation. So now, next, Barry, let's start taking a look at the two matches that we want to talk about today. So, Barry, first of all, we're going to go to May 20th, 2017 in Chicago, NXT TakeOver Chicago. This was the match that Barry Rose chose last week as his favorite NXT match of all time. We're talking Tyler Bate versus Pete Dunne. I know, Barry, you're a huge Pete Dunne fan. You've mentioned that here before. Why don't you tell us what you thought of this match and why you think this was the greatest NXT match of all time?
Yeah, so and definitely, I'm definitely biased towards the British style of wrestling. I'm watching NXT is doing NXT UK right now, which is on the WWE Network, and I'm just transfixed. I love the British style of wrestling. Some of my favorite wrestlers, and again, I'll date myself, Billy Robinson, who I've said multiple times is my favorite professional wrestler of all time, Jeff Ports, the father of Scott McGee, Tony Charles, Les Thornton. These guys were fucking studs in professional wrestling. And it was less about the show. It was more about the technical side of wrestling. And I just eat that up. And that is my favorite style of wrestling. I love a good brawl, but at the same time, I just love to watch some of the shit that these British guys can do. So that being said, I gushed like a 10-year-old schoolgirl when we were talking about this match. And any opportunity I have to go back and rewatch this match is a pleasure for me. With all the shit that I see that I don't like, which is generally 3 hours on a Monday night between the hours of 8 and 11 Eastern Standard Time, I get something like this, and this is 20 to 22 minutes that's well spent. So in looking at this match too, you know, you've got, in my opinion, the clear definition of a real clear-cut babyface and a real clear-cut heel. Tyler Bate, he's the ultimate babyface. The guy was fucking 20 years old when this match was filmed. He was 20 years old. That's insane. Pete Dunne was 23 years old. How in God's name do you become that good that quickly? Nigel McGuinness refers to, and he says this, I don't know if you caught this, he goes, both of these guys have been competing for over a decade. So I'm guessing Tyler Bate was 10 when he started, and Pete Dunne was 13, or that's a little bit of hyperbole coming from Nigel McGuinness. But they're just tremendous. Pete Dunne, I love this whole finger bending thing. And he's been doing this since I first saw him in NXT. The whole bending of the fingers and snapping the fingers.
Barry, can I interrupt you for 1 second?
Absolutely.
I have a quick question because you brought this up. You know, that's something also that the guy that I really am a big fan of, Marty Scurll, does. And yes, I wonder if this is like something that's like a British thing, you know? Because the only other guy I can remember doing that, like recently, I know that that Raven did that in ECW, but that is not something with the whole breaking of the fingers or manipulate, as they said, manipulating the fingers or the joints. That's not something you see a lot of. So I didn't know if that was just a British thing.
I have to assume, and you're right, because when we saw Marty Scurll, he was doing it. He's been doing it ever since he came to ROH. I don't know if he does it as much as he used to. Then again, I don't watch ROH as much as I used to. But I'm a big fan of Marty Scurll, as you are. But Pete Dunne, to me, total package right here. Tyler Bate hits an exploder suplex. And Tyler Bate, what is he, 5'7", maybe? 5'8", max? And he's got thighs like Bruiser Brody. I mean, he looks like he's got football player thighs. And he gets Pete Dunne up, and he holds him. And I want to say they say he holds him for 3 or 4 seconds, and he does an exploder suplex. I mean, it's just a thing of beauty. There's another spot, too. Dunne catches Bate. Bate's coming off of the middle rope, and I guess he's flying backwards, and Dunne catches him with a forearm. And I don't know if Dunne slaps the knee or not, but the sound it makes is just, it's beautiful. And fucking Tyler Bate goes down like a ton of bricks. A lot of near falls. And what I liked about these near falls, this wasn't sometimes there's definitely this overkill with near falls, and you're getting these near falls where it's one every 30 seconds and that goes on for 10 minutes. This is near falls where you're pretty sure this is it, and it's not. There's a lot of innovation during this match, and I wrote that down because I'm seeing a lot of stuff that I don't normally see. And then one of the commentators literally a minute later says, we're seeing a lot of innovation in this match. So, you know, I definitely could see where I was getting this from. It was definitely there. This is something that really stood out to me, Jeff. Now, you have been really vocal and really critical of this is awesome chants. Fight forever. This is awesome. A lot of these fan appreciation chants, and a lot of them are bogus. You know, you do one fucking maneuver. Sometimes guys will come in the ring and stare at each other, and fans already start. This is awesome. The fans here, though, the appreciation, and I think there was a this is awesome champ. It was brief. But the appreciation from these fans for what they were seeing were fans standing up and clapping during the match. It was almost like we were seeing something not taking place in the U.S. And it was Chicago, so it was the U.S. But it's there was this real honest, not bullshit type of appreciation for what these guys were doing. There is a spot as Bate delivers a moonsault on the outside of the ring, tosses Dunn back into the ring, and then hits Pete Dunne with this just stunning corkscrew 450 splash. And again, I go back to this guy was 20 years old. Incredible. Dunn does come back. His finishing maneuver, which is called the bitter end, hits it on Bate, and he wins the title. So it was a title change, which I love. But this is just such a holy shit match. And I'll tell you what's funny, and I realize this is all opinion-based. My opinion means nothing more than anybody else's opinion. But in reading some of the comments that were online about this match, there were some fans calling this match boring. And, I don't want to criticize because, again, it's all opinion. You know, look, if it's boring to you, then that's fine. It's boring. But I truly question your understanding and your world of professional wrestling if you find a match like this boring.
Yeah. They may have been under the influence of some inebriants if they thought this match was boring, because I got to be honest with you, when Barry mentioned this last week, I had never seen this match. The only reference I've been in, because let's be honest, I watch NXT when Barry says, hey, there's an NXT show you got to watch. I had seen a reference to Pete Dunne in the wasn't he in the War Games? That was unreal. Yeah. Okay, so I knew him from there. Tyler Bate, I was like, who the F is Tyler Bate? That's how out of it I am with today's wrestling scene. And then I sat down. I really appreciated the fact that they did a 2.5 or 3 minute video recap of what led to this match, which really kind of sucked me in because, you know, given credit where it's due, they did an incredible, whether it was NXT, WWE, whoever, they did a great job of setting up this program, setting up the match and the feud between the two guys, the issues between the two guys, you know, showing interviews with the two guys. And here's something I've said before that I really like. They don't look like everybody else. There's not like 60 tattoos all over the guys. And, you know, I like the whole thing with Pete Dunne wearing a mouthpiece, you know, and I know that sounds like really simplistic, but I don't see anybody else doing that. Do you, Barry?
I think there's two other guys that do it. One is Bobby Fish does it, and Cesaro does it. Cesaro does it, I believe, based off of that injury he sustained.
Okay, but my point is, it's not like tattoos where every other wrestler has a tattoo. So that, yes. I like the fact that he doesn't seem like he's playing a character. He seems like he's just this guy that's a real badass that has felt like he's been stepped on before, and by God, he's coming back to do stepping on the people that have, taking advantage of him when he was younger. He's got a real chip on his shoulder, and it really is part of the character. And it really, to me, is a huge selling point. And I think this guy, if his size doesn't limit him, has a huge future as a guy, as he goes up the level of the WWE. Now, Tyler Bate, when I first saw this guy, I said, oh my God, this guy is so small. What is he going to do? You know, because when you're that size, you have to be Jushin Thunder Liger. You have to be Tom Billington. You have to be somebody that is so obviously above, head and shoulders above everybody else. That's the only way you're going to get noticed. And so I was like, okay, this guy's really going to have to be something special. And wow, was I impressed by Tyler Bate. And again, Barry, like you said, 20 friggin' years old when this match is going on. Absolutely amazing. What I thought of was, this is kind of a weird mix. He's a weird mixture of Bob Backlund and Kushida. Does that sound fair, Barry? Because
I could see it. Yeah.
He kind of physically reminds you of Bob, like you said, those huge legs and the, you know, the short haircut, sort of the bit where he waves like he's some sort of beauty pageant contestant, you know, and he's like just ultimate baby face like Bob Backlund was back in the day. But he's doing crap like Kushida does for New Japan. So I really appreciated the intro, the wrap up. So Jim Ross comes on there, and, you know, first of all, I don't understand why Jim Ross was calling this match specifically. I'm not that deep into the storyline, but he comes out and starts doing the tip of the cap to the fans. And the first thing I thought of was, oy vey, please, Jim. And, you know, because I remember when Jim Ross was first brought into the WWF, you know, I'm talking maybe 94, maybe a little before that, the whole idea of Vince wanting him to become good old JR, he completely hated that. And now he's coming out to the Oklahoma University fight song. He's tipping the cowboy hat like he's got cow shit on his boots or something. He's completely become this character that he didn't want to be. I mean, I realize that was like 23, 24 years ago, but anyway, so, let's see. You talked about the chants. One of the things that the fans would do is the fans of Tyler Bate would start chanting Tyler Bate, Tyler Bate. The fans of Pete Dunne would start chanting Bruiserweight, Bruiserweight, which was, you know, again, really, it was interactive, but it wasn't like interactive where like they were trying to take the match away. Like these people, like, you know, this is awesome, that kind of crap. You're right. The stiff forearms and the exchanges of holds was definitely a very British thing. It's, again, what I appreciate about that, Barry, is it's not something you see every day. And that's what made this so compelling, because you're watching a match where it wasn't a guy's giving each other 4,000 clotheslines and then punches to the face that nobody's selling. This was something different. I tell you what I really liked was the X-plex by Pete Dunne, where he picks him up for a suplex, throws him on the side apron outside the ring ropes.
Oh,
that's just,
yeah.
I was like, oh my God, it was an incredible move, but holy shit, that had to hurt. And the airplane spin that Tyler Bate puts on Pete Dunne, where he must have done close to 20 to 25 revolutions. It was just amazing. You don't see that kind of airplane spin anymore. And it was something, because you don't see it, it was something I really appreciated. If I, you know, if I saw someone doing an airplane spin every week, it wouldn't be that big a deal. But here he did it, and he did it to excess. And, you know, it was like you kept thinking, oh, he's going to stop now. And he kept going and going and going. And it was really, really exciting. You mentioned the corkscrew 450 that Bate did, which was incredible. Dunn wins it with the bitter end. The match goes about 15 minutes, but this is not a match where you sit there and you go, oh, that was like really quick. Just like a really good match, if it goes 60 minutes, you don't sit there and go, oh boy, that match was, you know, if it's a great match, you don't sit there and notice. So this, you're thinking, wow, this has been like a half hour match. Oh no, this has only been 15 minutes. Terrific match. Definitely worth going out of your way for. I definitely give a big thumbs up of approval to my man, Barry Rose, for pointing this match out. You know, a lot of times I find matches that Barry doesn't know about and he's able to watch them. Well, in this case, folks, I give kudos to Mr. Rose. So I'll raise a beverage to you, Mr. Rose, for pointing this match out to me. Good, good stuff. Highly recommended, Barry.
Yeah, and I will take that, and I will clink our glasses as the two best friends that you didn't know that you had, if you're listening. But it is tremendous, too. So there are other matches between these two that are out there. There's at least one other match that I'm aware of, and it is spectacular as well. I don't know if it's at the level of this match, but it's right there. So I definitely, if you're a fan of either of these guys, I would definitely check that one out, too.
All right, so now we're going to Toronto to Maple Leaf Gardens. We're talking June 29th, 1980. Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood, truly one of the great, great babyface tag teams of all time, taking on Jimmy Snuka and Ray Stevens, who, you know, we talk about people that are great tag team wrestlers. We mentioned guys like Terry Gordy, Bobby Eaton, guys that have been in more than just one tag team. And Jimmy Snuka definitely belongs in that pantheon, because you think about all, you know, Paul Orndorff, Terry Gordy, Ray Stevens, Jimmy Snuka, good Lord, he was with a lot of guys, Bruiser Brody in Japan, and made a great tag team partner, Barry.
Yeah, so, and this is odd. So my 1, 2, 3, 4, my sixth line of notes says Stevens was a part of so many great tag teams.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah, so you bring up Snuka, who was, you're 100% right, as usual, Jeff, 100% correct, whether it's Orndorff or Terry Gordy or Bruiser Brody, but, you know, Ray Stevens, everybody thinks of Ray Stevens, and we did our our tag team episode, which is what got to be a year ago now or close to it. We did our tag team episode. We talked about, I think I said the greatest tag team of all time. And I don't know if I said Stevens and Patterson or Stevens and Bockwinkel. I think I said Stevens and Bockwinkel. But you think about it, these guys were a tag team in the Carolinas. They were world tag team champions with Gene Anderson. And then they were a tag team, if I'm correct, in the WWF. Because when Jimmy Snuka turned babyface, it was based off of an attack with Ray Stevens, right?
Very, very famous angle. When I was getting back into wrestling at that point, that Stevens angle where he pile-drived him. And boy, Jimmy just hit a gusher. And that was very hardcore stuff for the WWF at the time. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, it was great. This is a great match. And there's no way, you know, you could tie one arm behind each of these guys' backs and you'd still have a fantastic match because you've got Steamboat and Youngblood, most underrated tag team of all time or underappreciated. And anybody that's seen their matches knows how great they are. And they were together for several years. But when people talk about the pantheon of great tag teams, it is guys like Bockwinkel and Stevens or the Von Brauners or the Rock and Roll Express. You know, I'm sorry, Steamboat and Youngblood, they're right there. They're 100% right there. Steamboat also, this is a cool period. This is the era where Steamboat was working on the porn mustache. So I had to take a look at this. I had to get like right up to the screen and go, what the fuck is that? But this is that period of life where he was trying to pull a Ron Jeremy, I'm going to assume. And, he's going with the porn look on that. Snuka here is really the find. Because, you know, Jimmy Snuka, especially in the WWE, was breathtaking. But at the same time, boy, he's a fucking bump machine in this match. He's flying over the ring. He's great. I like a heel Jimmy Snuka with the boots on.
That's actually a question that I wrote down, Barry. Do you like the wild man heel Jimmy Snuka or the babyface Jimmy Snuka better?
Oh, I like this wild man heel. I like this jet black goatee, the hair over the eyes, the boots. I don't like the whole coming out to like jungle music and shit. I like what you've got here, which is a guy who's like, he's like a loose cannon. That's exactly what he is. So I thought he's fantastic. If you watch him in this match, and then you have to say to yourself, so what happens when you go to the WWF at that period? Because I don't recall him ever having a match as good as this match was. And I know that they neuter you a bit or a lot when guys would go up to that area. You know, you were, I guess it was a different audience. They would tailor it a different way. But I mean, you know, I'm watching Jimmy Snuka right here. And again, one of the comments that somebody said was Snuka should have had a run with the NWA World's Heavyweight title. I don't agree with that. But at the same time, Snuka was as good as any heel out there at this stage of his career. He's just fantastic. Trying to see what else. It's an old school tag match. This is the shit that you and I grew up watching, Jeff. This is a match that, you know, could have been a main event at the Miami Beach Convention Center or the auditorium in Savannah. Wherever it is, this is tag team wrestling the way that we grew up watching. You know, one thing was sad about this match. You watch it and you go, okay, Gene Anderson's on the outside. The referee is Terry Yorkston, who was an old time worker based out of Canada, out of Toronto. And the only person that's still alive is Steamboat. You know, Youngblood, obviously. It is. It's sobering in the fact that, you know, it isn't that long ago. But Stevens, obviously, you know, he lived a life, and he died at a relatively young age, in his 60s. Snuka just died the last couple of years, stomach cancer. Youngblood was a young guy, and that's very sad. But, Gene, you know, they're all gone except for Steamboat. And I saw Steamboat, I don't know, month and a half ago, and he's in better shape than you and I are. He's, you know, he's just tremendous. He's just fantastic. And that's a guy that I think is going to live forever. I think Steamboat, and I absolutely think he's going to live forever.
So, yeah, so let me ask you a quick question, Barry. You know, like I said, Ricky Steamboat, dare I say, probably led a bit of a more simplistic lifestyle. I'm not saying that Ricky wasn't out there having a good time too, but you know, it's not a huge leap of faith to say that he wasn't out there quite as much as Stevens, Youngblood, or Snuka. But as I watched this match, we're in the Maple Leaf Gardens. And the Maple Leaf Gardens had one particular attribute that later came into play when the pay-per-view started, and that is the dreaded ramp. Were you a fan of the ramp, yes or no?
I'm a fan of the ramp with a caveat that I didn't grow up seeing a ramp anywhere. So when you see this ramp, it's unique to me. And it does, I don't know who else ever did a ramp in the 70s and the 80s, other than the WWE when they started doing it. So I like it. I will tell you, and I have to find this, there was an incident, which is probably around this time. It would have been either late 70s or early 80s in Toronto, where a fan tried to get to Ray Stevens, and I want to say was trying to climb up that ramp to get at Stevens, and Stevens kicked the fan in the head, and I guess he fell backwards and hit his head on the concrete, and I want to say there were lawsuits, you know, a bunch of shit went down. I haven't seen these articles in years, but I'm sure that I still have them. I will find them, and then I will scan them, and we'll put them up in the group. So long-winded answer to a short question. I like the ramp.
Well, you know, here's what I didn't like about the ramp. I didn't like the ramp when New Japan would do like the Tokyo Dome shows, and you would do the spot where the guy would drag his opponent 20 to 30 yards down the ramp, leave him down there. And then like Muda used to do this, and then he would run 30 yards into a clothesline after running 30. Yeah. It just, to me, just seemed kind of pointless. So I, to answer my own question, not a huge fan of the ramp. I don't mind the way that the WWE has it, where you have the stage and then like the gradual incline where they go down and then get to the ring. I don't mind that. But I'm not a big fan of the ramp going all the way to the ring. So here's a couple things I noticed about the match. Quite frankly, my notes were, this was not a top 100 of the decade match, but what it was a really, really solid, good match, and something that anybody could watch and go, wow, this is a really good match. I mean, compared to crap that's out there, this is definitely worth, you know, spending, 20 minutes of your time to watch four guys that are Hall of Famers. You know, a Hall of Fame babyface tag team. Snuka's a Hall of Famer. You know, you talked about Snuka. Steven's certainly a Hall of Famer. While I don't think you're right, I think you're right. I don't think he would have made a good NWA world champion. It would have been really interesting to see him as a single, maybe managed by Anderson, going after the world champion in a lead heel kind of role. That would have been pretty interesting, Barry.
Yeah, Al, you're 100% correct. I feel like there was money left on the table when it came to Snuka. And Vince obviously saw the potential there, because Snuka, until he got derailed, you know, and I don't want to get into the whole, did he kill her, did he not kill her? Evidence definitely suggests something happened. But until that happened, Snuka was really on pace to be one of the biggest superstars of professional wrestling. And you got to give Vince credit, because he was able to see that early on. My opinion, I would have much rather seen him stay with Crockett, be a heel, and chase maybe a babyface Ric Flair, something like that. That would have just been legendary.
Yeah, and, you know, giving credit, he did a move that I'd heard he did, but I'd never really, I don't think I've ever seen it until that. He does the springboard leap that was made popular later in the decade by Brian Pillman and Owen Hart. And when I saw Snuka did it, I really popped. I said, holy shit, Jimmy Snuka. You know, here 8 or 9 years before Owen Hart and Brian Pillman is doing the springboard leap. So, yeah, so we will post links to both these matches that we want to recommend. So now, Barry, before we get to our game show topics, had a few people that sent in questions either a little bit late or we didn't get a chance to get to. So, Barry, you ready for Q&A part two?
Boy, we are cramming a lot in this episode, aren't we? I love it.
You are getting a lot for your money. Oh, well, we're not really getting paid that much. So, you know.
That's true.
All right. So, Tony Chirichietti, and I butchered that name to hell, I'm sure, Tony, wants to know, Barry, tell us your thoughts on the Ultimate Warrior.
Yeah, so that it's an easy one, too. So, Ultimate Warrior was a guy that was, as a wrestler, limited as being generous. But he drew money, he put butts in seats, a lot of kids loved him, had maybe one of the best entrances in professional wrestling in the 80s. I was never a fan. I liked to see wrestling, and, you know, he really couldn't do a whole lot. Again, he drew money, and that's really what this business is all about. It's putting butts in seats and making some dollars. Not a fan. You know, I don't like the whether it was true or not, I didn't like the smear job that was done on him with the documentary that the WWE put out at one point, and they had, you know, people that he worked with just saying what a horrible wrestler he was and not a great guy and just not bright. Definitely made a lot of mistakes. You know, I don't know. Just I'm sorry he's dead. You know, he left behind a wife and two younger kids. It's a tragedy. But as a professional wrestler, I guess I wasn't a fan.
I will agree with that. I was not a huge fan of him either. Somehow this guy went from being Jim Hellwig to changing his name to the Warrior or Warrior. And, yeah. You know, I don't know what was going on with all that, but that just started getting a little strange. Not a fan of his work at all, needless to say. But Barry's absolutely correct. Here we talked about a great promoter, a great booker, knowing what to do with somebody. And Vince took this guy and he made money off of him. And the guy got a character that was extremely over. There's no question. He worked very hard at getting the character over. And you have, you know, that's the name of the game, is putting asses in the seats and drawing money. There's no question he did that. But I've also heard a lot of negative things about the guy. He apparently wasn't the nicest guy to a lot of people. So, you know, again, like Barry said, you know, respect to the departed. But, yeah, I don't think neither one of us are big fans there, Tony. So Stan Guzik wants to know, Barry, who are guys that you would like to interview? Who would you like to have here on the old Breaking Kayfabe interview? I thought of two guys right off the top of my head, Barry.
So did I. So I actually went I went one guy in the USA and one guy in Japan. So if I could pick out anybody in the U.S. to interview, he's 86 years old. He's not in good health. It's the great Mephisto, Jeff.
And
the
great Mephisto, good choice.
Yeah, because he's a link back to the 50s. He booked. He punched Roy Shires right in the face. And he quit San Francisco. He ran opposition to Bill Watts. He booked and worked in Florida. He was all over the place. And just to me, that's a guy that I would, you know, when I'm doing these fan fests, that's a guy that I tried to get. And because of health issues, he won't go more than, you know, a few miles from his home. The other one is Ricky Choshu. And I think we've talked about previously, I forget what the question was. It was something like, Jeff, if you could go out to dinner with one Japanese legend or something like that. And I forget who you said, but for me, it was Ricky Choshu.
Yeah, no question. He was a very pivotal figure in Japanese wrestling during the 80s. He was also did a tremendous job being the booker for New Japan in the latter part of the 80s. So very good choice. My choices, Barry, a guy who showed up on your CWF group. I'm not sure which one was the CWF archives, but you had posted a story about famous angles in Florida history, and you were talking about the angle between Don Morocco and Barry Windham. I would love to sit and chat with Don Morocco.
Yeah, and, you know, you almost had the choice. You almost had the chance, not the choice, because we had reached out to Don about doing a fan fest. And Don's family was, and I'm sure I relayed this story to you, Don's family was coming to the States, coming to Florida, and I believe it was for a wedding, and Don was unable to make that trip. He has trouble because of all the years of wrestling with putting his body on an airplane, in an airplane seat, and going across. So everything I get is he's never going to leave Hawaii. It's just too painful for him. But he is great, too. And that was the angle was the Don Morocco, Barry Windham angle, which you actually wrote a part of that as well. And to see Don respond to that, that was I texted you. I'm like, how fucking cool is this? Yeah. Don Morocco actually adding color to this angle. So super cool.
And the other guy that I thought of, I didn't go international hero. If I did that, I'd have to give it some more thought. But I was thinking about a guy that we've discussed here many times when we talk about CWF 1982. I'd love to get some thoughts from Hacksaw Butch Reed.
That's a great one, Jeff. And Hacksaw Butch Reed is, I don't know if he's ever done a podcast or if he's ever done any sort of interview. I know he's done a couple of fan fests, but I, you know, he's a guy that's underexposed as far as, you know, his career. We don't really know. We know what we know, but he's never really commented or talked about it. So I'm with you. I think that's a fantastic one.
Yeah, the only thing I know that he's done personally is maybe done a dinner here in Fort Lauderdale, but I'm not going to throw that out there for public knowledge. So next, James Knight wants to know, Barry, why is Nicolas Cage so polarizing?
Part of that's a mystery to me. I'm going to say Nick Cage is polarizing. Nick Cage started off fantastic. Valley Girl is, in my opinion, it's one of the great movies of all time. And his early years, and he's had a hell of a career. He's guy's been around now for what, you know, 38 years, something like that. So he's been around for most of his life acting in movies. At some point, Nick decided that he was going to take the shittiest roles possible. And I don't know if he sees something different in those roles than we do. I don't believe it's all for the money, though I'm assuming that I know that he's had financial difficulties, that a lot of it is. But Nick Cage in like Ghost Rider, which is not the greatest movie, he's very good in Ghost Rider. So he's capable of elevating a movie at times, but at the other, you know, sometimes he gets these movies that are just the biggest pieces of shit, and he's not capable of elevating it. I also think too with Nick Cage, I think I don't know what Nick Cage's range is. I don't know. Am I off there with the range? When I see Nick Cage, it's like I kind of know what I'm going to get.
You know, here's the thing. He starts off, and I think we've mentioned this before, a minor part in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which, by the way, my wife and I sat and watched last night. Still great. He does Valley Girl. And he starts becoming a much more well-known and accepted. You know, let's face it. Con Air was a great movie. Face Off, John Woo directed, he and John Travolta in Face Off, which is a great action film. And I personally enjoyed the National Treasure movies, both parts one and two. I thought they were very good popcorn, pop culture movies. And then as he was like, he had become the biggest star, you know, I want to say in this country, the biggest movie star, like almost like Tom Cruise level, as far as, you know, being a face that everyone recognizes, and his movies are, you know, when they come out, are a really big deal. And he had all this money and he starts buying stuff. And it's just like he went out and bought like issue one of Superman just because he could. And Lord knows if I had that, you know, if I had that kind of money, I'm sure I'd be buying shit that, you know, other people would go, why are you buying that? But anyway,
sure. So would I. Right.
So he's putting all this money out. So then there's some sort of financial trouble. I don't know what it was. But, you know, whether it was like he got some bad investments or bad financial advice, that's when the crappy movies start coming out, you know, where, you know, it's he's making these almost, I would say, direct to video movies. But, you know, there's not really not videos anymore. So just really crappy. That being said, he had a movie that came out this year that I have seen as an under the radar great film that, dare I say, maybe down the road in our new Breaking Kayfabe movie of the week. Have you heard about this movie, Mandy?
I don't think I have.
Yeah, it's almost like a, I think it's a horror film. It's a horror revenge film it's supposedly it's Nick Cage being out there, you know, but it's a supposedly a really interesting plot. And it was something that nobody was expecting it to be well received. But apparently I've heard some pretty good reviews of it. And so maybe it's something in the future that we'll have to talk about. So good question from James Knight. Andrew Betts wants to know, Barry, what is your favorite hockey movie? And there should only be one answer.
Come on. I mean, Andrew, what the fuck? I mean, really? what's the best hockey movie of all time? It's the greatest sports movie of all time. It's motherfucking Slapshot.
And yes, yeah, so, I mean, okay, so let's talk about movies that are decent hockey movies that aren't as great as Slapshot. How about that? So, Barry, what you got?
I don't know. What are the other ones that are out there?
Okay, so look. Youngblood.
I mean, really? Youngblood?
Well, no. Youngblood was it's really? Nowhere near Slapshot, okay?
Yeah.
I think Miracle was a good hockey movie. Mystery Alaska was a good hockey movie. Again, these are good films. They're nowhere near Slapshot. So Slapshot is the only answer, and we'll leave it at that.
It's the penultimate.
Yes. Yes, that's movies, exactly right? What it is. So, okay, next we have Jonathan French wants to know, Barry, Hollywood Blondes or The Stud Stable?
And I like this question too. So as much as I like the stud stable, because you had a couple of old grizzled veterans in the stud stable, the Hollywood Blondes, Steve Austin and Flying Brian Pillman, you had a magic there. And magic doesn't always occur in professional wrestling. They you know, shit looks great on paper, and it doesn't work when you actually put it together. This worked, and this was something that, you know, only the ineptitude of WCW could have fucked this up. But they were a great tag team. We were fortunate in this sense that, you know, they broke them up. Stone Cold Steve Austin left. He went and became a megastar. But these guys were magic together. They were fantastic. They were tremendous. If you set another team other than the Hollywood Blondes up against the Stud Stable, I might say the Stud Stable, but I can't when it's the Hollywood Blondes.
No, and, you know, the amazing thing is how well-remembered Brian Pillman and Steve Austin are as a tag team. Again, considering, like you said, the fact that they just completely screwed the pooch, the promotion, with this angle. Because if they had taken any time and actually built around this team and created an angle around them, and, you know, the flair for the old, you know, I'm sure Ric Flair wasn't a huge fan of having it pointed out that he was getting older, but
right,
they could have really done something. You know, they were successful, but what they could have become is something, you know, that's just, oh man, they just completely blew it with that team, because they were money waiting to happen. And no matter how successful in a limited ability, you know, a limited way they were, that what they could have been was just something much nicer. So going to go out of sequence here. Barry, Aaron Grafton, Aaron, have we heard from him before? I don't know that name. Anyway, he wants
cuddly,
to know Barry.
The cuddly Aaron Grafton.
Yes.
Sure.
Yes. The guy that would not buy an adult beverage for the young lady that night at the residence at Marriott. So Aaron wants to know, Barry, go back in your time machine, if you will, now.
Yes, sir.
Tell me if you could go back in your time machine and pick two guys from the primes of their life and have them involved in a shoot fight, who would it be?
I never even saw this question.
Well, I'm bringing it on you there, buddy.
Yeah, you did. I didn't even see that one. Two guys in the prime having a shoot fight. Danny Hodge versus Muhammad Ali. And I don't know why. I guess because I got the gun to my head right now. And Alex Trebek was about to, yeah. So, yeah, I would say Danny Hodge versus Muhammad Ali.
I'll tell you
why I'm saying that too, because Hodge was also, he was an AAU boxing champion as well.
Of course.
So, yeah.
I mean, you know, obviously boxing wise, he wouldn't be up to Ali's skills, but, you know, Danny Hodge.
No, but still, right.
Yeah. Danny Hodge was one of those guys that everyone that had any sort of knowledge of Danny Hodge would tell you that if Danny Hodge got a hold of you, it was over. I'd like to see Danny Hodge, Kurt Angle in their primes. I think that would have been a inside the octagon. I think that would have been a hell of a match. I was also thinking Carl Gotch in his prime versus Billy Robinson might have been an interesting match.
Yeah. So everything I get, and again, I'm the biggest Billy Robinson fan, he wasn't at the level of, say, a Gotch. He was still, you know, above 99% of the people that he was working with. He was still a shooter and could take them down. But Gotch apparently, and I, you know, I'm only going off of what I've heard, Gotch apparently was in a level all to himself, kind of like this guy, George Gordienko. If you've read anything about shooters, George Gordienko, who was I believe he was Yugoslavian, but he was from Canada. He was blacklisted at one point for communism. Apparently, he could fucking just tie you up a million different ways and was at the same level of Gotch, because Gotch apparently was right there. So that's a good one, too. You know, maybe Gotch versus Hodge. Yeah,
that would have been good. Or how about this one? Here's a name that only people that really have looked into this sort of like the true shooters that I've read about, and that is Gotch versus Bert Azzarotti. Have you ever heard of that name, Barry?
Yeah, so Bert Azzarotti from England. He's a British wrestler. Okay. Another guy that just supposedly just used to fucking kill people over there. A real badass. So yeah, that's good. These are all the shooters. Absolutely.
Okay, next question, Barry. Barry, give me your your favorite and least favorite angle of all time.
Ah.
Oh, Seth Hansen. Okay. Thank you for that question, Seth.
Seth Hansen. How are you doing, Seth Hansen? Going to be tough, Jeff, because again, I've got 47 years of great and horrible stuff right there. So my favorite angle of all time might have been the Joe LeDuc heel turn when he turned heel on Jimmy Garvin on television in Florida in 1979, and he put Jimmy Garvin in the bear hug, and Garvin started bleeding from the mouth. It was so impactful on me. And we all knew it was coming. They had been teasing this now for a month, so we all knew it was going to happen. But Joe LeDuc went from the friendly Canadian giant to this raving fucking lunatic within 2 minutes' time. And to me, it was just masterful. My least favorite angle of all time, Jeff, is one you're very familiar with, which is the Mike Graham Freebird angle. And I hate it. And I look, I get that Mike Graham, this was his idea. He gave the full permission to do this, but I, you know, there's a certain, and I realize wrestling is tasteless from A to Z to begin with. I get it. You know, there's no surprise here. There's no culture involved. I get that. At the same time, Eddie Graham was such an icon in the state of Florida that to do a suicide angle within 2 months of his suicide and to use that as the impetus for an angle, I just, there was something wrong with it. And obviously it didn't last. Freebirds were gone maybe 3 weeks after. You know, could it have generated heat? I don't know. I just found it was tasteless. And again, I know wrestling is tasteless. I get that. I realize Mike Graham gave the okay on that. But as a fan, as somebody out there, and even at that stage, I was, you know, I don't know if I was a smart fan or I was relatively, I understood what was happening. It just struck me as wrong. It struck me as, wow, you know, your father kills himself and we're going to work this into a wrestling angle to make a couple of bucks, which, you know, we're not even talking WWE money. We're talking fucking Florida money, which wasn't anything in 85. So, it's obvious. That's my least favorite angle of all time.
Okay, well, I tell you what, Barry, before I answer this question for Seth,
yes,
the next question I was going to ask you was submitted by Tony Erba. Barry, tell us your memories or your thoughts, since we just briefly touched on it, on Eddie Graham's suicide.
Yeah, so there's no secret here either. So I'm a little connected to this whole thing, and I'm very, very friendly with his granddaughter, who is Mike Graham's daughter. So I will tell you, you know, there are a lot of experts online. There's a lot of geniuses online who will tell you why Eddie Graham committed suicide. And I don't think it was any one thing. I think it was a combination of things. That being said, I've always been very respectful because this woman has lost not only her father, but her grandfather and her brother to suicide. So it's not a joking matter. It's not something that, you know, people will, you know, there was a joke that somebody put forth about Eddie Graham and guns. And you know what? Sorry. I, you know, there's a line. Look, and I'm pretty out there with a lot of the shit that I say. At the same time, there's a line that I draw. And one of the things I've done in my Facebook group, which is the Championship Wrestling from Florida Archives Facebook group, we're 8 years running, is nobody is disrespectful to anybody, whether it's one member to another member or even the wrestlers. Look, you don't have to like a guy like Big Daddy, who wasn't a good wrestler. At the same time, I don't want people coming into the group shitting on the people that I'm trying to honor. All that being said, it was a tragedy when Eddie Graham killed himself because he was not a perfect man by any stretch. There was a lot of people that will tell you very sordid stories, and a lot of those stories are true. I get that. But at the same time, he left behind a family. He left behind kids. He left behind grandkids, people who loved and idolized him. And it was a tragedy what happened. Did it change the course of Florida wrestling? It did. Florida wrestling was already dying at that point. We were already on the downside. Maybe it just kind of, you know, kind of pushed it along a little bit quicker. But Eddie, at that point, I believe it stepped back to begin with. He wasn't as involved. He was, you know, he had always been a very, very heavy drinker. I believe it was out of control at that stage. And it was tough, you know, and it was it tough for me. So I was, again, a semi-smart mark. And I think I turned on the TV and they referenced that he had died. I don't know if they used the word suicide. I looked into it and then I was able to find that out. And what it said, and I think I was 21 when it happened, it was kind of that, like, okay, professional wrestling in Florida is in the past now. And again, at 21, I wasn't as deeply into it. You know, we were getting late at that stage, Jeff. So that's, you know, that's definitely going to take precedence over professional wrestling. It should. And let's be honest, it really should take precedence. And if it's not, you have an issue. But it said to me, it was a very somber moment because it said to me, you know, part of your childhood, I grown up as a kid, you idolized Eddie Graham because he was, you know, Gordon Sully put him over like nobody else would. It was incredible. So I knew when Eddie Graham killed himself, that part of my childhood, part of what I had grown up spending 10, 15 years, you know, just really immersing myself into, those doors were shut. And I don't think it was ever the same. And granted, it was only two more years than the company folded. But I think those last 2 years, I don't think I was ever the same because it really signaled a shift. So it was a tragedy. And again, you know.
So where you talked about how Eddie had stepped back, in your opinion, yeah, was there a certain point in, you know, the early 80s or in the mid, when exactly did you think Eddie started stepping back?
Eddie started stepping back probably around 83, and you can see it. And there were
and when, Barry, dare I ask, did I say that CWF began its downward slide?
I think you said 84, right?
No, I said it was the right after the Ron Bass turn, which was, I want to say, late summer of 83. So yeah, I don't think it's a huge coincidence that as Eddie Graham started backing away and he gave more and more power to Dusty as the booker and as the lead babyface, things weren't being as, you know, all the T's weren't crossed, all the I's weren't being dotted, that Eddie would have taken care of. You know, the small details that made the promotion so great weren't being monitored and checked off because, you know, Eddie wasn't as involved. And so your point is absolutely well taken.
Yeah, and again, I think it was the combination. It was the alcoholism was really taking a toll. I think he knew Eddie, you know, look, genius. I'm not the only one to say that. Eddie is considered a professional wrestling genius. And I think he saw the writing on the wall with Vince McMahon going national. And, you know, Terry Funk will always tell that story, how he knew this was going to happen years before. If Terry Funk knew, Eddie Graham knew. So Eddie was watching his business go away. He had made some bad real estate deals. He was in fighting alcoholism. There were some personal issues that were taking. It was, you know, it was everything. It wasn't just one thing. It was literally everything in his life was just kind of collapsing around him. And then he made that decision, you know, and it's, I'm sure everybody's heard that story about Mike Graham being at the Super Bowl and being paged. And then having to find out that his father had killed himself. So it's a real tragedy. And there are certain days, you know, that are real tragedies within any sport. You know, you can talk about the Pittsburgh Pirates and everybody's going to bring up Roberto Clemente and the plane going down, you know, whatever, Yankees, Thurman Munson also plane going down, whatever it is. But for Florida, you know, there are two events, and one is Eddie Graham's suicide. So, yeah.
Sure. So, okay. We appreciate your thoughts on that. And Tony, thanks for a great question. Just to finish up by answering Seth's question from my point of view, my favorite all-time angle, you know, we've talked about my love for the Buddy and Bill show and that run during Memphis, my love for the DiBiase Flair Murdoch angle in Mid-South. Of course, Dusty's babyface turn here in Florida, of course, is a favorite of mine. Here's one that not a lot of people talk about as being one of the great angles that I just loved. Is when I got Barry Ric Flair's babyface turn against Gene Anderson's crew, which I think was the Iron Sheik and maybe, I can't remember who the other guy was. But I remember the Iron Sheik was one of them because they did the thing where they broke Ric Flair's nose with Gene Anderson's cane. And the reason I remember that is because Ric Flair's interview to set up the program with him and Valentine was so probably, I think, the greatest interview Ric Flair ever did, which is really saying something, where he does this thing and they're showing, hey, he's talking to David Crockett and they're showing the clip And Ric Flair, as he's being, you know, he's getting the boots put to him by the Iron Sheik. He says, you know what they're saying to me right now, David? They're saying, get up, American boy. Get up, American boy. And he says, David Crockett, they went to a picnic and I was the roast. And it was just epic and awesome. And if you ever get a chance to see a clip of that, that to me, for my mind, that's Ric Flair's greatest interview ever. And that covers a wide, wide amount of years for sure. Okay, next question. Ron Gardner, very important question, Barry. Mayo or Miracle Whip?
I don't know that for me it makes a big difference. So I will, I think I like both. I think I'm going to say mayo, but I like both.
I'm going to go Hellman's Mayo. I hope that answers Ron's question for him here. So, okay, John Paul Manganelli wants to know, Barry, tell us your favorite underrated feud of the 1980s.
Yeah, that's our buddy Mango that we saw at the ROH show. So this is a tough one, and I don't know. So the reason I'm going to say this one is underrated, and some people wouldn't say, is I would have liked to have seen it in a major promotion, and by that being the NWA. Gino Hernandez, Chris Adams versus the Von Erichs. And when I say the underrated, I get it. In Texas, it wasn't underrated. They were fucking selling out stadiums and shit like that. But it was, you know, this is something that, could you imagine if they had taken this feud, this intensity, and brought it to the NWA? I just think it would have been just fantastic. So does that fall into the most underrated?
No, absolutely.
Feud? Does that work?
I'll give you two that I came up with as I was sitting here. Owen Hart versus Muckin Singh.
Great.
Mike Shaw at his absolute zenith. They ruined this guy when he left Calgary. Bastion Booger, yep. Norm the Trucker, Norm the Lunatic. When he was Muckin Singh, he was absolute money. And Owen Hart, as the babyface coming after him, was absolute gold. The other one I came up, a Florida feud, Barry, that towards the end of the last great Florida feud in my mind was Barry Windham and Ron Bass. We're talking like 1986. They was one of the bashes at the beach, or what do they call it? Is that what they call them? Why am I drawing a blank on that?
Not Clash of the Champions. Jesus Christ. Even I'm drawing a blank right now. Battle of the Belts.
Battle of the Belts. Wow. Right now you can hear about 70 people going, fucking idiots. How could you forget that? But yeah. No, they did a match in Daytona that I think was the first match on the card that night. It led off the TV, and it was just I know Barry like just sliced himself open seriously, but just a great brawl. And I got to see these guys and matches in Fort Lauderdale at the War Memorial, and just a great program that was just two guys that knew what the hell they were doing, having really, really good matches. So
I'll give you another one too. And it kind of jogged my memory when you said towards the end of the promotion. So there was a feud that took place in the last 6 months of CWF, and it was Dory Funk Jr. versus Mike Rotundo. And it was a great feud. It was kind of the second coming of Funk versus Jack Briscoe. And, they were having these really kind of rough scientific-based matches, but they, you know, much like the Jack Briscoe, Dory Funk Jr. matches, they would get out of hand, but it was two guys who really knew how to work. Those were some amazing matches.
Okay. Barry, John Lee wants to know, and I think we have both referenced this question in previous shows. Barry, tell us who the older member of your family was that may have either taken you to wrestling or got you into wrestling.
Yeah, and I think you're the exception on this, Jeff. So much like probably 99.9% of everybody listening, it was my father that got me into professional wrestling. My father, he knew some professional wrestlers from his days in Columbus, Ohio, and he took us to the matches. I got to introduce me to some of the wrestlers, and that began. And I think my formative years were me going to professional wrestling matches, and it just, you know, it's one of these things that I try to explain to my son. I don't think it's ever going to go away. I think I'm going to be 70 or 80 years old, and I'm still going to love professional wrestling.
Sure, and for me, I've said it on more than one occasion. My maternal grandmother, Corrine Button, Queen Bee of Beaufort, South Carolina. We would go, my mother and I would go up there pretty much every summer because I was the youngest child. So mom would drag me up there with her for 2 weeks. And every weekend that I was up there, we would shut the house down and stop what you're doing because wrestling is on. And Grandma Corrine and my grandfather Herbert Bunton would sit at the breakfast table and watch them professional wrestling. So that's the answer to that question, John Lee. Brian Huff wants to know, Barry, what is your favorite city that you've ever lived in?
Yeah, and that's a tough one, too, because the truth is, if I've lived in the cities, I've liked them, most of them. It will be New York City, and it'll be New York City the first time I lived there, which was really late 1983, early 1984 when I moved there. And I was this kid coming from Miami Beach, a condo on Miami Beach, to being thrust into the underbelly and the disgustingness of New York City. And I loved it. I absolutely embraced it. It was the coolest fucking thing I'd ever seen. So I would say it was New York City when I first moved there in the 1980s.
I'm going to say when I was a young kid, about fifth or sixth grade, my father, who was in the Navy at the time, was stationed at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. They called it Gitmo. That is, of course, now where they hold the Al-Qaeda prisoners. The maximum of all the maximum prisoners, of course. But Guantanamo at the time was a base, I want to say between 6,000 and 7,000 military personnel that were there. So you essentially had one elementary school, one junior high or middle school, and one high school. And so you pretty much knew every kid in school. And it was like, I've told people, it was kind of like living in maybe a RFD, which for some people might sound like completely, oh my God. But it was just like living in a small town. Everybody knew one another, and it was good times. So I would say that was, of course, that's the memory of someone when they were 11. Now, if I went back there, because, I loved living in Belleville, Illinois, believe it or not. Shout out to Jim and Mona. When I was in high school there, I went back, and you know what? You find out you can't go home again because that town that you remember when you were a senior in high school, it's different now. Now, and instead of cornfields, there's Walmarts and Subways and all that kind of stuff. And, yeah. Time moves on and progress and all that kind of stuff. So I found out that the town that I had left isn't there anymore. So what's that Chrissy Hynde song? Yeah. My City Was Gone. I went back to Ohio. My city was gone. So next question is from our friend from Japan, official New Japan representative of the show and Facebook page, Barry. Ashley Kamick wants to know, Barry, what are your thoughts on Jay White, the Switchblade?
Jay White is he's a superstar, and he's going to be a bigger star than we even think he is. And I saw Jay White at an ROH show 2 years ago, maybe a little bit more. It may have been his ROH debut in Philly, and he wrestled, and I think it was a tag match, and he was wrestling the Briscoe brothers, and they were beating the shit out of him. And it kind of said to me, this is your indoctrination, because they were stiff. You could see it. And Jay White is he's spectacular in what he does. I kind of think his future, though, he's going to be sky high. I don't see where he's going to be capped at all. I think Jay White can do it all. He can play babyface. He can play heel. I think Ashley and I like him for different reasons.
What?
Yeah, I believe she might be attracted to Mr. White.
No, come on.
I'm not. Yeah, I'm picking that up by the amount of slobber on her post that I could see when she posts about Jay White. But you know what? More power to her, because we should all have the feelings about professional wrestlers that she have. And I know that in certain females, I do have that. But I think Jay White is long story short, Jay White is fantastic. I think at this stage of his career, which is still young, he's doing extremely well in Japan. And that should just tell you that he's got, 20 solid years in front of him. He's going to be a top-level player for sure.
Yeah, no, I don't think there's any question that, even as big as he is and over there now, I think within the next 2 to 3 years, you're going to see the guy just completely take off. And if, as some have speculated, if Omega and the Young Bucks leave, you could see Jay White becoming the face of that franchise from the non-Japanese point of view. So, he's going to be the foreign star that becomes Kenny Omega at some point. Friend of the show, Jeff Zinger, wants to know, Barry, Let's make sure Mrs. Rose is not listening. Tell us your favorite all-time porno star.
So my favorite?
I mean, back when you used to watch it, like when you were, you know, late teens.
Oh, in those days.
Yeah, because, of course, now, you know.
So I'm going to go back to the 1980s when I think it was probably a little bit more fun. And there was a young lady who was of Native American descent. And I don't know if she was truly Native American or, and I believe she was. Her name was Hyapatia Lee. And she was jet black, long jet black, silky hair, beautiful features, natural body, nothing crazy, but she was just beautiful. But she was great. And, you know, I think it's a certain look that I've always been attracted to. So the fact that she was making pornography certainly endeared her to me. There was some sort of controversy with her later in the, I guess in the 90s, where she faked her own death and she was off the radar. And then she came back with some sort of excuse. And she had gone through this nasty divorce with a guy who was a porn producer. And I believe she was like Miss Nude. I do know a lot about her. She was Miss Nude.
Apparently.
World. Apparently so, but it's all stuff that I've just read from other people. Not that I knew this, but
never.
But she's, you know, look, the '80s. It was so much fun in the '80s as a viewer. You know, certainly whatever takes place now, I think is at a different level. But we're talking classic porn stars, and I think she was my favorite.
Well, I see. Now, I thought based on your love for Pam Grier, you were going to throw out Vanessa Del Rio or something like that. I will say, going back to that time frame, I will say Christy Canyon, who had, as Bob Seger once sang, she had good points of her own sitting way up high. And that's why I was a fan of Christy Canyon. So that would be my choice. Okay, last question for the Q&A. Barry, I saved this one because this could be either very short or very long-winded from both our points of view. Barry, Joe Christie wants to know, what are the keys to a good marriage?
Oh, good God.
Good question, Joe.
Yeah, Killer Joe. Killer Joe Christie. So I'm married 20 years this year. So I'm a little over 20 years as I will approach my 21st. As with anything, Jeff, there are ups and downs, which we all know. The keys to a good marriage, I would say, really comes down to a few things. One is respect. I won't make jokes for the one time. This I won't make any jokes, but I do think it's respect. I think it is listening, and I think it's communication. And I can tell you that mistakes that I've made, it comes forth without listening and then not communicating either how I feel or not paying attention to how she feels. And those are the mistakes that I've made. So that's what I would put it. It's communication, respect, and listening.
All good, valid points, Barry. I will ask Joe to lean forward, grab the headphones if you're listening on the headphones, because I'm going to lay some advice on you here, Joe. Joe, I don't know if you're getting ready to get married, if you're considering it. Maybe you have a young lady that you're thinking about popping the question to. You know, I watched a movie with James Stewart called Shenandoah. Barry, did you ever see that? Civil War Western Shenandoah?
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. And in that movie, a young man played by, I believe, might have been Doug McClure, came to Jimmy Stewart to ask for his daughter's hand in marriage. And Jimmy Stewart, as part of his fatherly advice, said, "Let me ask you a question. Do you like my daughter?" And the young man said, "Well, of course, I love her. I want to marry." No. That's not what I ask you. I ask you, do you like my daughter? I loved her mother when I married her. I didn't really like her. I didn't know her that well. Over time, I liked her. And to me, that's the ideal situation. You have to really like the person that you marry. You know, I tell people, and I'm not going to get all soapy and sentimental, you know, my wife is like my best friend. She's the person I hang out with more than even Barry Rose, for God's sakes. And if you don't really like the person, you are in for a heap of trouble. I will tell people, I said it to my wife, my first two wives, I loved both of them. But in retrospect, I realized when I married him, I didn't like him that much. I was in love with the idea of being in love. So, so you really got to have that likability. You know, you have to have that connection, almost like as friends. And if you don't have that ability to tolerate that person on a bad day, you're in it for a lot of trouble, you know? So anyway, that's my advice for Joe. Barry, you ready to talk some game shows, my friend?
Let's play the feud. Yeah,
I guess we know it's your number one choice. Okay, folks. So what we decided to do was the question came up, as I said, from Ryan Damon. Great question, Ryan. What is your top five game shows or favorite game shows? So as we started going through, we started talking about it. Barry's like, well, I don't know. Like, when we, so we threw two out to each other and we both said, oh, well, obviously those two are the best. But what are there, you know, can we really come? So what we decided is we're just going to throw some names out and say whether, because as I started talking to some people about it, everyone has their own idea of, you know, you think about it. I'll throw one out there, Barry. One of the things I think that is really shows that a game show is really over in pop culture is when people start making fun of it. What show has been made fun of more times on Saturday Night Live than friggin' Jeopardy and Will Ferrell skewering Alex Trebek with that deadpan look on his face? So obviously Jeopardy is something that people, you have to throw out there, Barry.
Yeah, and Jeopardy too. I mean, Jeopardy's a game show, but to me, it's obviously for a much more intelligent viewer than most of the game shows that I used to watch. And whether I'm an idiot, which really isn't even debatable at this point, but I like to watch game shows where I thought shit was going to go down. So one of the game shows I was watching in the 80s, and I was living with this, it was the same young lady that I talked about with going into the kitchen in the complete darkness and eating a whole bunch of, I think it was ho-hos, and they were covered in ants. So I was living with her. But one of the things we would do is we would actually videotape the Love Connection, and we would watch the Love Connection every night. And, you know, it was airing during the day, but it'd be 10 o'clock at night, and we'd be in bed. We're like, all right, let's put in the Love Connection, and we would watch it. And it was great. And it was, you know, hey, you had Chuck Woolery, who was great. He really kind of one of those cool game show hosts without being, I don't know, I guess he was a little bit younger than a lot of the other ones. A lot of the other ones were older and sometimes came off a little sleazier, and Chuck being a little bit younger. But I loved the Love Connection, and a lot of it was sometimes people would actually have a great date, but a lot of times these dates went south right off the bat, and these people would start to go for each other. And I know, you know, a lot of this is scripted, and maybe it is, maybe it's not, but I used to look so forward to watching that show.
So I'll throw another one at you, Barry. So as I said, it's great when a game show is so much a part of the pop culture that you can skewer it on a show. And one of the greatest all-time examples of that was the way that when it was at its zenith in Living Color, got the dating game, and they had the character that Jamie Foxx played of Wanda participating in the dating game with, I think Jim Carrey played the host, and I don't know if you've ever seen that, but it was the dating game with Jim Lang. What a fantastic show that was. And so many people that were like ended up, you know, I know Schwarzenegger competed on the dating game, and there are other celebrities that apparently competed in the dating game, Barry.
Yeah. So, hey, I'm going to sidetrack, but that Living Color was a great TV show, and it was kind of groundbreaking when it was taking place. But there was a block of shows that would take place on Sunday night on Fox. Do you remember the block of shows? And Living Color was kind of like the staple, but you had Get a Life, the Chris Elliott show, which I just fucking loved. And then you had this Parker Lewis Can't Lose. Do you remember this show?
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, I know the one you're talking about. Yeah.
Oh,
was that was Married with Children still on in that block?
Yeah, and Married with Children, I think, was on that as well. That was part of the block. So that was great stuff. But Jim Lang was cool. Jim Lang, who was Jim Lang, always reminded me of my father. He looked like my dad. A little more hair than my dad, but he had the biggest smile on his face, and he would always wear these really gigantic bow ties as well, which really didn't seem to go with anything. But you were right. Schwarzenegger was on there. I want to say Tom Selleck.
We have Schwarzenegger, Tom Selleck, Farrah Fawcett, and Jerry Mathers, the Beaver.
The Beaver.
Trying apparently to get some. But
good God. Yeah. Wasn't there? So there was a story, and you know what? I should have done some research on this one, but there was a story. Wasn't there a killer a guy who was a murderer on that show, whether a serial killer or a guy that was either, I guess, arrested after the show. There was a guy who was a killer on The Dating Game. I'm like 99% sure of it.
I will have to bow to your knowledge on that because I don't, I've never heard that.
That's story, all I remember, so. Though. I don't have any details.
I'm going to riff here and throw out, let's make a deal with Monty Hall where people would dress up in costume to try to win prizes, Barry.
Yeah, that was a fun show too. And I think as a kid, that was the one that, you know, you would stay home from school, as you and I were talking about. Game shows are on, and you would watch game shows all day. And Monty Hall, I think, was always around noon. It always came on at noon. Let's make a deal. And it was fun. It was brainless, didn't require much thought. Right place, right time. Had to answer a question, have some idea. And it would happen. And how many years was that on? That was on for like 30 years or something?
Well, seemingly, but according to my statistics, 1963 to 1975.
No, there's no way.
It's been probably been rebooted a few times, but in its original form, and I think what happened was it was on the networks, and then it might have gone into syndication. So gotcha, maybe we're seeing reboot. By the way, a voice in my ear has told me also that a person that was on The Dating, Steve Martin, was on The Dating Game, Barry. So that's one more person.
Was that your best friend? Did your best friend tell you that?
I'm not going to say who it was. And maybe later in the show I'll reveal. Hollywood Squares. Paul Lynde as the center square, Barry. From 1966 to 1981. That show was money in the bank. Paul Lynde, Charlie Weaver. You know, that was just some classic shit, Barry.
And Charlie Weaver, who was an Arquette, if I'm correct, wasn't he?
Yes,
he was like the... He's the grandfather to the acting Arquette family. Peter Marshall did a great job. Peter Lecoq, which you've got to be a badass if your last name is Lecoq.
And whose son played Major League Baseball and was a first baseman with the Chicago Cubs in the mid-70s, as I recall.
Yeah, Pete Lecoq. And that was a great show, too. And that was a good Waylon Flowers and Madam. Remember the –
Yes.
Very effeminate guy, and he had an older woman, like a Gloria Swanson from Sunset Boulevard, was the puppet or the marionette, sure. Whatever it was.
Then we got from 76 to 85 was the original run with Richard Dawson of Family Feud. Let's play the feud. And Richard Dawson just kissing every woman that ever came on the set, Barry.
Yeah, is that Richard Dawson, who's a member of Breaking Kayfabe with Badger and Barry on our Facebook group?
That's a different Richard Dawson.
That's a different one. Yeah, that was a great show, too. So he was great because we've talked about Hogan's Heroes multiple times on this show, usually in connection with Bob Crane. But Richard Dawson, who would have ever predicted that he would be like this kind of sleazy pimp-like figure as he's doing the show. Seems like he's had a few cocktails, cigarette in hand, and kissing every woman. And he took that, and he was great as the game show host, MC, in Arnold Schwarzenegger's film, The Running Man. It was essentially the same guy.
Yes, that's right.
He was
yes.
fantastic in that.
So, yeah, other hosts of the show have included Ray Combs, who I believe died of a suicide, Barry, John O'Hurley, Richard Kahn, Louis Anderson, and now Steve Harvey. I'm reading here about the show. A sample question would be, quote, during what month of a pregnancy does a woman begin to look pregnant? And at one point, when Richard Dawson was hosting, one of the responses was September.
Okay, that's pretty awesome, too.
Oh, Barry, how about Alan Ludden, Password?
So now we're going to go back to my youth. Now, he died, I guess, I don't want to say young. I mean, he was married to Betty White. That was Betty White's, like, lover of her life. But he was a guy that was around forever. And he couldn't have been too old because he's been gone for so many years. Password was a big deal. Game shows were a totally different beast in the 1970s going into the 80s. It was, you could put these on at prime time and the entire country would be watching these shows. And then the next day, everybody would talk about it. It was water cooler talk. Sure. So yeah, he was a class act, Alan Ludden. Kind of like the Nick Bockwinkel of game show hosts.
Yeah. So then we got, how about To Tell the Truth with, I believe it was Gary Moore. And To Tell the Truth always had Kitty Carlisle and Bill Cullen and Peggy Cass And then they'd have a fourth person in there. And I used to always ask myself, what the hell did these people at the time? I didn't know Kitty Carlisle had been in all those Marx Brothers movies like 30 years before. But I never was quite sure what exactly Peggy Cass did.
Yeah, so and you're right, too, because as kids watching that, we were like, who the fuck are these people? It was Kitty Carlisle Hart. I had no idea. I had no idea who any of these people were. Gary Moore, I believe, was the husband of Lucille Ball, if I'm correct. But I remember watching this show, and I remember reading the obituaries. Who was the other one? It was
Bill Cullen.
Bill Cullen. But I remember reading their obituaries, and I never heard about them when the show ended. Like, you never heard about him again. But when you read the obituaries years later, I was like, oh, that kind of sucks. You know, fucking Kitty Carlisle Hart was like 100 when she died, granted, but still, it was like, oh man, that sucks, you know?
Yeah. All right. $100,000 pyramid with Dick Clark. Dick Clark must have owned like 60 different game shows. That guy had more connections in Hollywood and TV productions than it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, so two of the biggest game show guys, I mean, it was always Mark Goodson and Bill Todman. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Those two names. But Gary Moore also produced a bunch of shows. Dick Clark and Chuck Barris from The Gong Show is another one that actually produced a whole bunch of these different game shows. That pyramid was great, though, and the pyramid had a pretty long shelf life. I think that was still going late 80s, maybe even into the 90s, right?
Sure, yeah. So let's see. We got The Price is Right with Bob Barker. Bob Barker first burst on the scene in my life as the host of Truth or Consequences, which was another great game show. But, of course, he's more famous for The Price is Right, which I think he was on for something like 25, 30 years, something like that. And that was a real big deal during its height. And now Drew Carey hosted, I believe.
Yeah, you got me, because I haven't watched a game show in probably 25 or 30 years. Barker was great, and Barker's still alive. I just read something. You know, he's 95 years old. He was having some sort of health issue. He's still around, but do you remember that scandal 10, 20 years ago where a couple of the girls were, suing him for sexual harassment?
That's what led to him perhaps leaving the show, I believe,
I think you're right, yeah. But yeah, it turned out he was actually having affairs with these women who were literally half of his age.
Yeah, so and a huge animal rights activist, too, Bob Barker.
That's right. So. And actually, he had that great, what was it, Happy Gilmore, remember?
Yes, the great he was very funny with Adam Sandler.
Adam Sandler, right. yeah.
So, bring up the last couple here. Wheel of Fortune. Of course, with Pat Sajak and Vanna White, which seemingly they've been together for 20 plus years. So that's a real popular. So now, Barry, let's get down to our two favorites. Before we do, one last game show I want to mention from when I was a kid. Do you remember these words, Barry? Joker, 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 Devil. Then you remember the Joker's Wild, of course.
Peter Tamarkin, right?
Yeah.
Guy who was the host, Peter Tamarkin?
Jack Barry. Jack Barry came out of the scandals of the game show era in the 50s and had got back in, was the host of The Joker's Wild when I was watching it in the 70s at least.
Gotcha.
I don't know.
I just got a note here. Our own
Yes.
This is awesome. This is Jeff. We
could tell Brian last. Brian Last is not
Who?
Working this show tonight
Who?
Because we are getting some solid intel.
This is fucking awesome. So we should give a big breaking kayfabe welcome. We have a new producer. Brian obviously is still our producer. Sweet Lou Kippelman is producing our show tonight for the first time, and he's such a professional that he's sending us all these messages, and I didn't see it until now, but it wasn't Gary Moore. It was Gary Morton, which is great, and then he's got the name of the guy who was the killer on the dating game, so there was a killer. This is fantastic.
Master of useless information, or he is working that Google right now. I don't know which one it is. So why don't you go ahead and tell everybody who the serial killer was that was on the dating game, Barry?
No, it gets even better. So, no, Jack Barry. Peter Tamarkin was Press Your Luck, the whammy. Lou, this is fantastic, Lou.
What about the serial killer? Who was the serial killer?
Rodney Alcala was the serial killer who was on The Dating Game. He's on death row at San Quentin. This is awesome. Yeah.
But it was, in fact, Jack Barry, who was the host of The Joker's Wild. So now let's
Whoa. So the last note from Lou, I'm a game show fanatic, was on a couple, in fact. So our own Sweet Lou was on game shows?
You go. We're going to have to get some intel from Lou on that. Lou, which game shows were you on? And so we can reveal them to the good folks. So while Lou is typing that in, let's talk about our two favorites, Barry, because when we talked about this topic originally, I said, well, I want to take this one or this one. And you're like, well, that's the two that I want to, you know, that I want. So, folks, we are talking The Newlywed Game and The Match Game. These two, to us, were just in a different stratosphere. Barry, you watch The Newlywed Games. Everyone would say the word whoopee instead of sex or some other euphemism for it. That and, of course, the most famous episode that's been constantly out there on YouTube, of course, is the one where is the strangest place you ever made whoopee? And the young woman said, in the butt.
Actually, so Jeff,
what?
So that's the urban, that is the urban myth. What really happened, because when you and I talked
about the video.
So I saw the video too. So the woman's name is Olga. And do we see the same video?
I'm thinking Olga? We did.
Okay. So the husbands are out first, and Bob Eubanks, the great Bob Eubanks,
terrific, you know, yes,
he's one in a million right there. The great Bob Eubanks is asking all of the husbands the weirdest or strangest place they've ever made whoopee, and they all have. One guy said a sink, another guy said a shower, you know, the kind of normal answers. Well, he gets the women on, and Olga comes on, and he asks her the question, and she's very nervous, and she's laughing, and it takes her, and she mouths the words, in the ass. So I saw this. I go back, and I start watching it, and lo and behold, because they beeped it out, but they didn't edit her out, she says, in the ass. Her fucking husband loses it. I mean, you have never seen a guy start laughing this hard. So that's a story that people have heard for years, but it's legitimate. Some woman really said, Olga, who really, you know, for the day, I'm going to guess this is early 70s. Yeah, you know, that's kind of risque in the early 70s.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Like,
yeah. So, by the way, Bob Eubanks, 80 years old, still with us, Barry. God bless him. So finally, Barry, we both decided that our favorite game show of all time was, of course, the original Match Game with the great Gene Rayburn, master of the double entendre and the side look that just always got people laughing. You always had Brett Summers, who, again, was one of these people. Why is this person famous? And, of course, she had been married to Jack Klugman earlier, but they were divorced. Charles Nelson Reilly, who, of course, was just flamboyantly gay, but middle America couldn't figure that out at the time. Richard Dawson. You also had Fanny Flagg that was kind of a regular on there. And was just
Charo,
the Hoochie Coochie girl, you know. And then later when Richard Dawson left, he was replaced by Bill Daly. Now, Bill Daly was very funny in I Dream of Jeannie, but he was no Richard Dawson. And the show, as after Richard Dawson's departure, really started kind of a downward spiral. But when Richard Dawson was on there, and I think they still rerun those things on the Game Show Network, for God's sakes.
Yep.
Those Match Game episodes with those three or four people and Gene Rayburn were just money in the bank.
Did you ever hear the Gene Rape? So there was a moment on Match Game similar to Newlywed Game. Did you ever hear that story?
Why don't you tell us about it? Because I'm drawing a blank right now.
Absolutely. So, you know, the whole show was really built around these suggestive double entendre. Everything was sexually related. You know, it would be like, so Joan decided to go to see her hairdresser because she really wanted to get blanked, and you know, and everybody would go, oh my god, you know, and people would laugh, but that was really the entire show. That being said, Gene Rayburn apparently was a major cocksman back in his day.
this is the kind of solid intel that you don't get in any other podcast, folks.
These other podcasts are talking about, you know, wrestling. You know what? Fuck that. We are going to talk about Gene Rayburn leading a game show that is basically coke fueled. It's, you know, this was the 70s. There were drugs. There were alcohol. Apparently, there was a lot of sex taking place there. And Gene Rayburn, who was not a great-looking guy. He was an older guy. He was big. He was benefiting from the role that he was in, and more power to him on that. But there was a young lady. Her name was Karen Lesko. And Karen Lesko came on, pretty attractive young lady as well. And Gene Rayburn is giving her a compliment, and he says to her, he goes, so she's sitting next to John.
I know what you're going
to
say.
She's sitting next to John, and John is who she's playing against. And he looks at her, and he's like the fucking, like the big bad wolf, you know? He's just like leering at her, and he goes, doesn't she have pretty nipples there, John? So immediately he corrects himself, and he goes, this lady has very pretty dimples in her cheeks. But you know, he was just such a fucking dirty old man. But he was awesome. This was everything to me as a kid, as far as TV shows go. And I have a friend, and I'm still Facebook friends with him. It's kind of like you and Mona Fishbein. You know, you've known her for so many years, and you went to school with her. There was a friend of mine named Clayton Randall, and I'm sure Clayton isn't listening to our show. And Clayton lived probably 15 minutes from me, but I would, every day after school, I would get off at his bus stop. We would go over to his house. We would eat as much junk food as we could find, and we would watch the match game. And then I would somehow try to get home and without having my mother you know, beat my ass wondering where I was for the last 2 hours. But the match game was it. And Charles Nelson Reilly, Mike, he was the Paul Lynde of that game.
Oh, you know, yeah. He was awesome.
He was awesome. These guys, and how we didn't, you know, and I guess as kids, we didn't care. We didn't put it together. I'm sure there were some people that had the suspicions, but he was so good. But even somebody like a Brett Summers that you referenced, I don't think I had ever seen her in anything either before. I think she did a Quincy once.
Yeah,
but really,
and she was very funny. She was very funny in the role on the match.
She was great. She was fucking Klugman. She was like a female version of Klugman. Yeah. She was this gruff. She had a gruff voice, a gruff exterior. Fanny Flagg was good. What made this show work besides the subject matter and the content, which really, as a young kid, you wanted to hear all this kind of sexual shit, which you would still want to today, was the fact that all these people seemed like they were best friends. And whether they were or they weren't, they succeeded in the fact that I thought they were all the best of friends.
Yeah. And, you know, like I talked about how, you know, Brett Summers, you know, like, why is this person on here? What did you – Peggy Cass. You know, the other one was on the Gong Show. I could never figure out what exactly did J.P. Morgan do that made her famous enough to be on the Gong Show. So as we're wrapping up, because we're closing on the old 2 hour mark and our producers are going to freak out on us, I will mention a couple of names. We talked about game show host Wink Martindale. Wink Martindale, Tom Kennedy. You had guys like you mentioned Chuck Woolery. These are guys that were part of the pantheon of our youth as we grew up, Barry.
Yes, and Wink Martindale, I saw him, there was a documentary, and I forget what the documentary was about, but he was on there, and it's a little, you know, I don't think he's worked in years, but he's trying to hold on to what he had, but his wife is not, so she's a much older woman, and Wink is, you know, I don't know if it's facelifts or just trying to, whatever it is, but he still seemed like he could go out there and host a game show. Tom Kennedy was the music one, right, where they would play one or two notes and you had to guess. What was that one called?
Oh, God, why am I drawing? Yes, you're absolutely right. Name that tune.
And, of course, Sweet Lou checking in.
Yes,
with Name
but
That
I got
tune.
It before Lou. Before Lou texted
how do
me.
We do that? How do we do a show before Lou
I
got
don't
involved?
Know. I don't know.
This changes everything.
I'm sitting here, all of a sudden, I'm having all these run-ons. I remember when you mentioned Tom Kennedy and Name That Tune, another one I remembered. Do you remember Bert Convy on Tattletales, where they would have the married couples come on? And yeah, that was great stuff too. Bert Convy, I think, was really good friends with Burt Reynolds. Like they were like running buddies. Yeah. So
two Berts. Sure, you had to be two Berts.
Yeah, we are getting to the 2 hour mark here, and Brian Lapp.
I just Go ahead. Brian Lass is going to take a big shit on this for sure, but I just wanted to check in. Sweet Lou has Bert and Bert created. It's the fucking great. Lou, it is your first show. You're getting a raise. This is unprecedented. You're just getting a raise. Bert and Bert created win, lose, or draw.
Hey, Lou, you broke your cherry. Thanks for joining us.
Lou did come in. He did say that his favorite game shows, and I guess the ones that he was on, was Win Ben Stein's Money, which
great show.
I loved.
Yeah.
Great show with Jimmy Kimmel in the early days, which I absolutely loved. And then Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, the daytime version. Lou was a phone a friend. So what a friend indeed right there. So great job tonight, Lou.
And Lou has certainly been a phone a friend here on our show tonight, Barry. So, folks, I will encourage you to follow me on Twitter at Baldrin Jeff. Breaking Kayfabe is a production, not tonight of the Arcade. Well, it is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, but tonight it's a production of Lou Friggin Kippelman. Welcome on board, Lou. And until next week, folks, we will talk to you, or I'm sure we're going to come off the air and go, oh, fuck, we forgot to talk about that game show. See you next week.